I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
It's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
But we ain't killing their army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, bitch, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, introducing Mike Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center. That's 10thamendmentcenter.com. Ooh, he got in trouble with the U.S. government the other day. Welcome back to the show. How's it going?
Hey, Scott. It's great to be on. I always appreciate you having me. This is my favorite show to be on, by the way.
Oh, good. Well, I'm trying not to screw up too bad.
Well, you can't screw up. It's your show. So if there's any screw up, it's my fault, right?
Yeah, probably not. So listen, when I say you got in trouble by the state there, I mean official government propagandists challenged your claims on official Russian propaganda channels.
Right.
So, okay, fair enough. These things happen. So you went on the RT and you made some claims. And then what happened was the Voice of America attempted to take you to task, I guess is the best way to put it. So let's start out with you carrying water for the Ruskies here. What was all that about?
Yeah, I was a Russian bot. And, you know, I knew I was going to get some crap for going on RT. And I get it. But my thought is, you know, if somebody's going to give me a platform to say what I'm saying every day and talk about U.S. foreign policy, particularly in this case, the economic warfare that the United States wages, which, you know, it's often the prelude for the shooting wars. We do all these sanctions and maneuver countries into a corner. So they offered to let me talk about it. And so I did. The original interview was actually a live TV interview. And then they did a little web story based on what I said on the thing. And basically what I said was that the United States uses the dollar as a weapon and that uses the SWIFT payment system, which is the global system that moves payments all across the world. It's done in dollars. And the fact that it's done in dollars gives the U.S. a tremendous amount of influence over it, shall we say. And they use this as a foreign policy tool, particularly to enforce sanctions. So this is what I said. This is really not debatable. And so the Voice of America, they have a fact-checking arm called polygraph.info, which I'd never heard of before. I don't really think a lot of people actually read this, but, you know, it's out there.
Yeah, not to be confused with antipolygraph.org, the great website of the heroic George Matschke there. Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, that's a much better website. Go there. But yeah, so they sent me an email and asked me a couple of questions and asked if I had been quoted properly, which of course I had because it was a live segment, so they really couldn't quote me improperly. And I made the decision not to respond to the email because I knew – you could tell by the tone of the email that they were basically going to – it was going to basically be a hit piece on what I said, and I figured that anything that I contributed would probably be – used against me or misconstrued. So I just decided to ignore their email, but instead actually respond to what I figured that they would say before they actually said it. So Michael Bolden and I got together, and he's the executive director over at the 10th Amendment Center, and we put our heads together and we decided, you know what, we're going to respond to this because we knew I had done some research. I know the Voice of America's position on this. They claim that the words that they use is that the U.S. government has no control over SWIFT, which is technically true. They don't have direct control over it. You know, they don't run it, but they have tremendous amount of influence. So I actually went through, did a real long article debunking what I knew that they were going to say, laying out the case, using a lot of documented information from mainstream news sources like Bloomberg and Reuters and others to show that the United States does indeed put pressure on SWIFT to cut people and banks and countries out of the payment system in order to push that foreign policy. And so I did that. We wrote the article. And interestingly, the Voice of America folks actually did their fact check based on the pre-rebuttal that I did, which was kind of fun. And we did
– which is big of them, by the way, that they could have just gone with what you said on RT, but they went for the more substantive follow-up. And listen, I mean, I have to say to you, my friend here, that their criticism of what y'all wrote is just devastating here. For example, they say – in February 2012, SWIFT responded to U.S. and international pressure and agreed to cut off Iranian banks from the system as part of sanctions against that country. So,
yeah,
obviously, you've been completely
wrong.
Refuted here.
Yeah, it was devastating is a great word to use. And, you know, I like the way Daniel McAdams, we had some back and forth on this as well, and Daniel put it really well. He basically said they confirmed everything that you said and then called you wrong.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that was the fact check.
Yep.
And, you know, this is the truth. This is a fact. The United States uses its position as the world's economic power. It uses the dollar as the official reserve currency. And they use that as a weapon in foreign policy. And, you know, people can argue. We can argue about whether this is a good way to use power or not. I say it's not, because I think ultimately it undermines the dollar and could have very bad ramifications on the U.S. economy down the road. But to try to say that the U.S. doesn't do that is just absurd. And the fact that they went to the trouble to fact check Mike Meharry, I mean, who the hell is Mike Meharry, right? Shows that this is a narrative that they really don't want to get out there in the mainstream. They really want to crush this down. And this isn't the first time they've tried to debunk the notion that SWIFT is a foreign policy tool. They did it way back in as far back as like 2012, 2013. So this isn't anything new. This is something that they don't want you to know.
Hey, but didn't they just succeed in kicking Venezuela out of SWIFT as well?
I think that they probably did. You know,
I should have Googled that while you were talking to make sure, but I could swear remember that from a few months ago.
I'm thinking that's true. And, you know, it's part of the broader economic warfare that goes on. And we don't talk a lot about that. We talk about the shooting wars, and the economic warfare is, you know, in some ways can be even more devastating. We know that some 300,000 children died as a result of economic sanctions on Iraq before the invasion of Iraq. That's a lot of kids. You know, that's a serious impact on innocent people because a bunch of governments are pissed off at each other. And we don't talk about that. And then, like I said, oftentimes this foreign policy tool is used and they maneuver countries into a corner. And then when the shooting war starts, the U.S. points the finger and says, look, they started this. Well, no, the U.S. started this years ago when they started putting economic pressure on. It's just another part of the warfare state that is kind of under the radar, but I think just as devastating and oftentimes the run-up to the real shooting wars. And if you are a non-interventionist like I am, if you believe that we should do everything possible to avoid these wars, to avoid killing innocent people, to avoid starving children, then we need to address the economic aspect of this as well.
Hey guys, I know you're going to love Will Grigg's new book we just published at the Libertarian Institute, No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg. It's wonderful. It's terrible. It's devastating. You'll laugh. You'll get angry. You'll miss him. You'll be inspired to fight for freedom. With perfect cover art by Scott Alberts and a brilliant introduction by Will's great friend and protege Thomas R. Edlam, it is a fitting legacy for a brilliant man and nearly tireless defender of liberty. Get No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg, in paperback or Kindle on Amazon.com. Well, I mean, and we're seeing this with Iran right now, where even under Obama, they were called crippling sanctions, and we know severely affected the population of that country. And now Trump's sanctions are much harsher because he's even gone ahead and, you know, banned the waivers for Korea, Japan, and other American allies in the Pacific who are heavily dependent on Iranian oil. And so, and we have reports out of Iran already, people going without medicine, of course, the destruction of their currency, not just by monetary inflation, but by the financial war against them. And, you know, the U.S. essentially is the world government. They can tell any corporation on earth, you better not trade with Iran or else. And other than the Chinese, pretty much any other company from any other country in the world must bow down to that, SWIFT or otherwise. And we see from, you know, there's no ban on medical exports to Iran. It's not like that. But what it is that the shipping companies just won't dare to defy the sanctions. The central bank isn't there to clear the transaction and all this kind of stuff. And so it just doesn't happen. The trade breaks down even without specific sanctions on those specific goods.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's interesting because the other narrative that the VOA people have put out is that the SWIFT corporation, the actual entity, is European based, and therefore, you know, Europe has control over it and it operates under European law, which is true. But here's the interesting thing. You know, the Europeans, the EU, Britain, Germany, they're not really as keen on this pressure on Iran as the United States is. In fact, they want to continue oil trade and various other interactions with Iran. They didn't want to remove themselves from the nuclear arms deal. So what the Europeans have done is they've created an alternative payment system in order to circumvent SWIFT and to circumvent the U.S. sanctions. So if Europe has so much control over SWIFT, that would raise the question, why in the hell did they have to create an alternative payment system in order to get around the sanctions? I mean, why couldn't they just put the pressure on SWIFT and say, hey, let us do our transactions? Well, they couldn't do that because the U.S. is the 500-pound gorilla in the room. And, you know, even China isn't immune. Back when the United States was ratcheting up sanctions against North Korea under the Obama administration, the United States directly told China that if they did not go along, if they tried to defy the sanction regime, that they were going to basically lock China out of the SWIFT system. And, you know, when you start swinging a billy club around, when you start bullying people, you need to watch out. You darn well better be able to back up what you're saying. And that's what really concerns me just from an economic standpoint, because, you know, all the Chinese really would have to do to cripple the U.S. economy is start dumping U.S. treasuries on the market. I mean, they hold trillions of dollars worth of U.S. debt. The United States depends on China to monetize the debt and actually maintain the empire that it has. It's playing with fire with these economic sanctions. We all know that the U.S. is probably, you know, not going to get beat in a shooting war, at least not directly. I mean, I guess they could get bled into oblivion. But, you know, the economic warfare is a little bit shakier. And countries across the world, Russia, China, and not just them, we're seeing countries like Poland, Hungary, buying gold, trying to diversify away from the dollar. So people are getting tired of it. And at some point, the house of cards is going to collapse and the United States is going to find itself in a position where the dollar isn't all that strong. And that's not going to be good for the U.S. economy.
Well, I just don't understand why you're such an isolationist.
Yeah, isn't that weird? And I'm not an isolationist. In fact, you know, think about this. We're arguing about sanctions. Isn't sanctioning somebody isolationist? You're trying to isolate them. I'm all for free trade. You know, I'm a George Washington, Thomas Jefferson foreign policy guy. Robust commerce with everybody, friendly relationships as far as is possible, and entangling alliances with nobody. And, you know, that's a big part of the problem is the U.S. has gotten into all these entangled alliances with countries like Israel and NATO and all of this stuff, and used that position to basically empire build. I don't think it's an exaggeration to call the U.S. an empire. Some people bristle at that because it has negative connotations, but, you know, we call a spade a spade. And, you know, I want friendly relationships with people. I don't mean anything against any Iranians. I mean, they've never bothered me any. So why don't we try to open up some trade, open up some negotiations, try to be friendly? I say that with all of these countries. It's much better to talk than it is to bluster and bully and ultimately kill each other. So, yeah, that's why I'm a quote-unquote isolationist. Mm-hmm.
It's really funny, too. You know, I'd like to see the list. I think there was a story like this. Maybe William Blum or somebody had a thing like this back a few years ago that listed all the countries that we have under virtual blockade to one degree or another right now. And it's probably more than half of them or something. Even though, you know, most of the countries in the world are America's allies, we still got sanctions on some of them. And certainly any so-called rogue state outside of the American world order is under layers and layers and decades of sanctions. And then, yeah, if you oppose that, there is no other term. I mean, American media, they cannot. I don't know if you even saw this where, I'm sorry, I don't know if you saw this where even they couldn't pronounce non-interventionism. They were talking, a TV station was talking about Tulsi Gabbard, and the guy's like, non-intervention. Sorry, that's such an alien concept to me. I have no idea what these people are talking about. There's only one fair description for someone who's against constant imperialism and invasion and regime change and carpet bombing campaigns, and that's an isolationist. And if you right. say you want to be friends with the whole wide world, just not sanction or bomb them, isolationist. Sorry, we don't have any other words for that. We can't even pronounce non-interventionism. And people can read about that, by the way, at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, fair.org. They had a write-up about that.
The other thing that's interesting in along those lines is, you know, people that get into any kind of prominent position that take a non-interventionist position end up getting unpersoned. You know, they're trying to unperson Tulsi Gabbard now. And, you know, there's a lot of things wrong with Tulsi. And I don't even know that she's the best foreign policy person in the world, but she's certainly more non-interventionist than anybody else that's out there in the Democratic Party right now. But, you know, you look at it, they're trying everything in the world to discredit her. They ignore her. When they do have her on, they throw hardball questions at her as opposed to the, you know, softball stuff that they throw at the other candidates. And we saw the same thing with Ron Paul when he was running. You know, I remember back in the day when you'd get the polling and, you know, they would have all of the leaders in the polls. And you noticed that there was like this big percentage that was missing. Well, those were Ron Paul supporters that they were just completely ignoring. So if you are a non-interventionist, if you actually believe that it's not a good idea to kill people all over the world, starve children, and cripple other countries' economies, well, then you deserve to be unpersoned and, you know, not even fit to have a voice on the stage. It's yep. the one place where you can always guarantee that you'll get bipartisanship, and that's when it comes to, you know, sticking its nose into other corners of the world. All of a sudden, we have all the bipartisanship you could ever want.
Yep. And, well, you know, the funny thing is, too, though, is for crafty politicians, this is a huge gap. This is a giant opening in the market for them to exploit in political terms. A new poll just came out, said the American people and the soldiers are all agreed by super majorities. More than 63% that say never should have fought the terror wars. In other words, forget it. The whole 21st century shouldn't have done it. Bush and Obama's wars shouldn't have done them. And so, you know, for Tulsi Gabbard or for anybody else who wants the American people to support them despite the wishes of the establishment and the central state, there you go. There's no better way to frame the opinions of the American people versus the opinions of those with the power than on the question of war and peace. And that's how Trump beat Hillary Clinton. And that's how Tulsi Gabbard or Bernie Sanders or whoever could beat Trump, if they just focus on the wars. And the fact that the media won't have it just makes it that much better, you know, for Gabbard or anyone else. Let's make that a talking point against the media. Maybe that's the yep. one thing about Ron, is he's just too friendly of a guy to scapegoat the media the way Trump did. But maybe if he had decided just to pick one public enemy, it could have been the media. Look at how much they hate me. Why do you think is the answer for that? You know what I mean? And just...
yeah.
Certainly in this time, I don't know about in 2008 and 12, certainly in 2020, that, you know, narrative is wide open for the taking.
Yeah, you remember those fond old days of the campaign where it almost looked like Trump might kind of try to be non-interventionist. And then you actually talked about the Iraq war being a debacle, and even in places like South Carolina, and that was well received. So that messaging didn't hurt him any. But, you know, you're just up against such a tremendous power when you talk about the military-industrial complex. And it's almost become a cliche. You know, you say that and people are like, oh, yeah, you're some kind of nut job. You're talking about the military-industrial. It's a thing. And it's a powerful, powerful thing. And it just goes to show how powerful it really is, because it completely overrides the voice of the average person out there. But, you know, I'm a little bit optimistic that there's more and more war weariness out there. And, you know, maybe this will get some kind of traction, because you've said this before. I completely agree with you. The number one issue is the wars. You know, I'm concerned about a lot of different things, and federal overreach and domestic surveillance and all of these kind of things, but so much of it flows out of the warfare state, the militarization of police, the surveillance state at the domestic level, the economy, the spending, all of that is attached and, you know, part of this, this warfare state that we've developed. If we could get rid of the wars, a lot of this other stuff would vanish on its own. So I'm with you, man. It's the number one issue. And, I just wish more people would vocally say what is resonating with the masses out there.
Mm-hmm. You can hear the Scott Horton Show and Anti-War Radio on Pacifica 90.7 FM KPFK in LA, kpfk.org, APS Radio at apsradio.com, the Libertarian Institute at libertarianinstitute.org, and of course, check out the full archives. More than 5,000 interviews now going back to 2003. And sign up for the podcast feed at scotthorton.org. And thanks. You know, there's that famous phrase from Gene Kirkpatrick, who was a neoconservative and was Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the United Nations, where at the end of the Cold War, in 1990, the USSR was still there, but the Cold War was over. And she wrote this piece. You know, I was familiar with the phrase. I didn't realize it was actually... she had written an entire article titled "A Normal Country in a Normal Time." And she talked all about how, forget greatness. This is an OG neocon, a real, you know, Shockmanite from the Social Democrats USA, turned Reaganite. You know, she is one of them. Absolutely. And she says, look, the greatness of a country is not measured by their heroics in foreign policy of righting all the wrongs in the world. It's the way that people live at home. And you know, whether they're free, whether they're safe, whether they can prosper and thrive, whether we're progressing on this, that, and the other kind of thing. And so that's what we need to focus on. Now that the Soviet Union is gone, we shouldn't think of them as out of our way. We should think of them as no longer justifying our attempt to dominate the rest of the planet in the name of protecting the planet from communism. It's dead now. We're okay now. And so... if you just think about if Richard Pearl and Paul Wolfowitz and Dick Cheney and all of those guys had all just had heart attacks and died right then, and you just had Gene Kirkpatrick and Brent Scowcroft and even Colin Powell or any of these kooks other than the very worst of the neocons and the right-wing hawks up there to hold that consensus. I mean, I don't know, Powell and them, they're pretty one-worlder types, but without the neocon hard-edge hawks pushing all of that stuff, I mean, it's pretty easy. I don't know. What if Perot had won instead of Clinton and had called off Iraq War 1.5, you know, that Clinton had waged? What if, or what if even stupid Dukakis had won and George Bush Sr. had never taken us to Iraq War 1? And just the whole 21st, the whole post-Cold War era was not based on bombing Iraq. And think of this, 30 years of bombing Iraq. And turn the whole Middle East inside out. And none of it had to happen at all. And just, what if they had taken Gene Kirkpatrick's advice to be a normal country in a normal time? And the only reason I'm going on and on like this is because, just imagine for a second, how different everything would be if we had just not had a foreign policy after the dissolution of the USSR. And instead focused on, hey, our highest political goal here is freedom for our own people, you know?
Yeah, the Iraq War One was such a turning point. You know, not only in the trajectory of foreign policy, but also in the mindset of the country, I think. you know, it was such an easy, clean war. It was on TV. I mean, I was just graduating from college, and I remember distinctly when that war started, going home after work and sitting on the couch and turning on the TV like this war was some kind of spectator sport. And, you know, we had all the technology, and the military learned its lesson from Vietnam, and they carefully controlled the narrative. They carefully controlled the media. You know, we had the yellow ribbons, and we welcomed the troops home victorious. And it was at that point that skepticism about war and U.S. foreign policy disappeared and was replaced with basically, I don't know, I hate to say bootlicking, but basically bootlicking, where everybody is thanking the troops. And, you know, and it was that success, quote unquote, that I think turned the mentality of the United States. And all of a sudden you had every football game, you had the patriotic displays and, you know, our heroes at home and blah-de-blah, blah, blah. That mindset, that change in thinking, I think has allowed this to go on. Because I think if we still had the skepticism that arose out of Vietnam, it would have been a whole lot harder for the United States to move down the path that it has.
Yeah.
But, you know, so many people have bought into it.
Robert Perry thought that that was the single most important overriding reason for Iraq War One. That after, as Perot said in the debate, as we all know, the administration has essentially invited Saddam to go ahead and take the northern oil fields of Kuwait.
Right.
And he just got carried away and took the whole thing. But then they saw the opportunity to have a short, quick war. No jungle cover, no Ho Chi Minh trail. We'll just blast the hell out of them from the air and send in our tank divisions and knock the hell out of this third world army. We'll talk about how big it is and not how weak it is. Mm-hmm. And it'll be a great triumph. And we'll tie a yellow ribbon around every tree. And then, as Bush Sr. said, I have the quote here somewhere. We have finally, by God, it's a great day for America. We have kicked the Vietnam syndrome. That was this terrible disease of the American mind that the people were reluctant to send their sons off to any more of these complete debacles. And Bush Sr., of course, had said repeatedly, and this was the cover of Newsweek, was this will not be another Vietnam. You know, that was 30 years ago.
Yep.
You know, we're still fighting in Iraq right now.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the thing that's interesting, too, I took a really interesting class when I was in journalism school, which was like 06, 07. And I was still pretty much in neocon mode at this point. So I didn't really appreciate it to the degree that I do now looking back. But it kind of traced the way that the media has reported war in the modern era. So we kind of started in World War II and worked our way forward. And the U.S. military learned a huge lesson in Vietnam. In Vietnam, they basically let reporters wander around and cover what they wanted to. And, of course, that resulted in, you know, pictures of bodies being brought home and the realities of the horror of war. And the Pentagon press people, they were bound and determined that that was not going to happen again, that they were going to control the narrative, that they were going to control the reporters, that they were going to make sure that the images and the messaging that they wanted out there was going to be what's out there. So they made sure that reporters weren't just wandering around reporting on stuff, you know, and it came to its head in 2003 when we had the whole concept of the embedded reporter. Well, you know, how objective are you really going to be when you're dependent on the guys next to you to protect your butt? You know, you're not going to say bad things about what they're doing or report on, you know, the horrors of war. It's going to be all cheerleading and propaganda. And that's exactly what it was. And, you know, as a media person, I miss the days of reporting on the reality of war. They need to beam the reality in, you know, go into Walter Reed and show these guys with their limbs blown off and their heads screwed up. You know, show the mutilated children that were killed in a drone strike. Make that real, because I think for most people, war is just this abstraction. It's a video game. You know, they're even using the damn video game imagery for Army commercials now. It makes me sick. Every time I see these Army commercials, it's like you're watching a damn, what's that video game that they all play? I can't even remember the name of it. But
Call of Duty. You know, yeah.
Call of Duty, yeah.
Well, that's no mistake either. I mean, It's not that the Army is necessarily behind all those games, but they work with them on all those games, and they have projects dating back to the 90s. There's even that Robin Williams movie, Toys, where it's all about just growing up drone pilots to be drone pilots from the time they're little kids playing these games. Ender's Game, same thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so it is, it's a huge network of, you know, we see the shooting wars, but there's a whole lot that goes on behind it of media manipulation, of propaganda, of economic warfare, of, you know, corporations and government entities locked together. And it's a gross thing. And you end up with a bunch of dead people.
You know what? And the plain truth of it is so plain to see, too. As you said, you know, people want to try to dismiss the military-industrial complex as some kind of conspiracy theory. Well, the phrase was coined by five-star general turned president Ike Eisenhower. What kind of nutball was he? He was saying, listen, the companies that sell the weapons to the military have a lot at stake. And you people need to use your democratic voting power to keep them in check, keep them from running away with this whole state. And guess what? We all know there never was a reckoning in all the time since then. They spend $1 trillion a year on militarism in this country. Oh, yeah, no, but that has nothing to do with why it keeps happening or anything like that. You're some kind of nut if you think that the cart could possibly come before the horse. I mean, it must have been the Soviets who coined the phrase self-licking ice cream cone, right? Oh, no, that was our Pentagon describing themselves. You know?
Yeah.
Give me a break,
man. I've got a relative that is a defense contractor. And my wife and I were actually talking about this the other day because I ran into him at a funeral. And he works in submarines. And the company that he works for is based in Indiana. And I was telling my wife, you know, kind of what he did. And she goes, wait a minute. Why do you have a company in Indiana making components for submarines? There's no oceans or water in Indiana. And the reason that they have companies like this that are involved in something like a submarine in an inland state like Indiana is it's political, because it makes it harder to shut the program down along the way. You know, when they decide, oh, we need to downsize this, the congressmen can all run out and say, oh, no, look, it'll take jobs away in 45 states if we get rid of this tank or this submarine. All of this is intentional.
Well, and Donald Trump, as much as Ike Eisenhower from the other point of view, has made this perfectly plain himself, repeatedly exaggerating the amount of money that America is making off of arms sales to Saudis. He even claimed at one point in the last few weeks that 1 million American jobs depend on selling weapons to Saudi. I mean, what a crock. Who could possibly believe that? But he does. Somebody told him that, and he went, oh, wow, really? Okay. And that's a thing of his now, is how America would go out of business if we weren't selling weapons. And the thing is it's a lot of money to the corporations involved. But in terms of the overall GDP of America, it's a drop in the bucket. You could fire every single one of these people that works for these arms companies and make them get real jobs, and it wouldn't cause a recession or anything. It'd be a blip. You know, it's the jobs that we're talking about overall are probably still in the low millions out of 350 million of us. So come on.
Right. Well, and instead of making bombs and things that we never get to use, all of that production capacity could be used to make things that actually people want.
But even in the transition, if I Dream of Jeannie fired them all and said, you all have to get real jobs now, it'd still be fine, even for the few weeks it took them to all find real jobs, you know? No big deal at all. No full loss. And then Trump comes out and says, oh, hey, it's $450 billion. So, in other words, I mean, how else do you put that? America is a mercenary force.
Yeah.
The USA on the global scene is there to kill people at the behest of foreign powers. Not that we didn't already know that, but that's the way the president himself explains it.
Well, let's look at the other side of the equation, too. You know, you can, the military and the defense contractors, they produce all of this GDP growth for the United States. Well, let's look at the other side. How much money is the United States wasting on all of this military interventionism? and look at the condition of the U.S. economy. We're $22 trillion in debt, and that's not the real debt. I mean, that's the official debt. The real debt's far, far higher than that. The Federal Reserve has to monetize all of this by devaluing our currency. So this is costing you and I a tremendous amount of money. For what? For nothing. I'm not getting anything out of this. I mean, somebody's going to say, oh, well, Mike, it's getting your safety. Well, you know, I just am skeptical of the idea of some poor Iranian peasant is a threat to my health and well-being. And, I put this at the end of the article on SWIFT to kind of drive home the broader picture. Since 2001, U.S. wars have cost each American taxpayer $23,000. So think about this. If you had had to write a check to the Pentagon every year for the last 17 years, you would have had to write a $1,352.94 check to the Pentagon every single year just to fund your portion of the war.
Right.
I damn well guarantee you, if people actually had to sit and write that check out, the wars would stop.
And you know, too, people want to fantasize and daydream and think, well, you know, my money went to provide cover fire for our brave infantry guys on the front line. But no, it didn't. It actually was just stolen, embezzled money that never did go to pay for some tires they didn't need for a plane they weren't flying or some insane thing. That every bit of everything they've taxed your entire lifetime, they piss away in, you know, an hour and a half. That's the sad. That's the part that actually makes me so mad too, because, you know, I'm a working class kind of a guy, and what's the hugest of margins to me was, you know, the amount of wealth they take from me and from people who make the kind of money that I make is everything to us. It's the difference between some health care for our wife or not. It's the difference between private or public school, or the difference between having bail money for your brother or not, or God knows what. It's everything to us. And yet to the government that taxes us, there's nothing. We're talking about fractions of remainders on the edge of a thing that was all just waste in the first place. You know, a whole lifetime worth of taxation just evaporated away into the ether, you know? Hate them.
I do too.
Sorry. I got a chip on my shoulder. It's not ever going away, Mike. I'm just stuck like this.
I'm with you because I tell you what, every single month, $350 disappears out of my checking account and goes to the IRS.
Man, oh man. Yep. And it ain't personal. It's, it's for everybody. That's the thing. And by the way, and I'm sorry, I'm so late and out of time. I wanted to talk less and give you a chance to talk more about the 10th Amendment Center. But what I will do is this, is I will tell everybody to go to your website. First of all, check out your this article at RT. U.S. is using SWIFT as a kind of billy club, is a story about Mike's appearance there. And then this hilarious confirmation in the guise of an attack on Mike is at polygraph.info. It's called RT falsely claims U.S. uses SWIFT as a weapon. And they go on to confirm every bit of it in right. there, of course. And then again, 10thAmendmentCenter.com. It's Mike and the great Michael Bolden over there as well. And they got write-ups for you on all of this. It's all about interposition, nullification, and the process of using power from the bottom up to tell the national government to stop as best as possible. It's really great stuff. And please, everybody, go look at it. 10thAmendmentCenter.com. Thank you very much again, Mike. Great to talk to you.
Thanks, Scott. It's always a pleasure.
All right, y'all. Thanks. Find me at libertarianinstitute.org, at scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, and reddit.com/Scott Horton Show. Oh, yeah. And read my book, Fool's Errand: Timed and the War in Afghanistan, at foolserrand.us.